Coming up on No Limits, with the advent of e-books and the explosion of other new technology, reading and the relationships writers have with readers have found themselves in the middle of a revolution. We'll talk today about the past, present, and future of books with the three finalists in the Indiana Authors Award Emerging Writers category, the president of the Independent Book Publishers Association, and you. We'll take your calls at 1-866-476-3881, your emails at nolimitswfyi.org, and your comments on Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're going to be talking today about books and really the past, present, and future of reading. We've got a great panel of guests. I'd like to introduce them real quickly, but before I do that, I would like to ask all of you to join the conversation, if you can, by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can also contact us and offer comments on Facebook via Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Greg Schwipps, who is the author of What This River Keeps, Michael Ling, who is the author of Three Islands, and Flory Benford Kichler, who is the president of the Independent Book Publishers Association. We're also trying to reach Douglas Light, who is the author of East Fifth Bliss in New York right now and having a little bit of difficulty making connections. The connection here is that Greg Schwipps, Michael Ling, and Douglas Light are the three finalists for this year's Indiana Authors Award Emerging Writers Award, which will be named on October 9th at the Indiana Authors Award Banquet, sponsored by the Indianapolis Marion County Library Foundation and the Glick Foundation. Welcome to all of you. Glad you joined us.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start first with Greg and Micah and get us started a little bit. I'm not going to ask the cliched question, which is, what's your book about? And I know, having written one, people hate that. But what I would like to ask is the question that I find most interesting about talking to writers. Why do you write? What drives you to do that? What prompted you to think that that would be fun? Micah made the dangerous mistake of making eye contact first. So, Micah, how about if you start with that one?
Sure. You know, it's one of those questions that you do get a lot, and it's one of those questions that's sort of difficult to answer because it's just something I've always done. I started writing as soon as I could. You know, I was always writing little just things to my parents. I don't know if you could call them poems at that point, but it's just sort of always been the way that I most easily express myself. So. I was always a writer, I would say. I found writing easier to do than even talking for a long time, and I would always sort of be writing something.
And is it still that way? Do you feel more comfortable writing or talking or?
I don't know if it's still quite that way, but writing now is sort of something that's necessary just for me to feel normal.
I should say here that Micah's book, Three Islands, is a set of poems about historical figures. Could you talk a little bit about how you structured that book? Because it was incredibly innovative. I also need to, in the interest of full disclosure here, say that I was one of the awards panel determining the Indiana Authors Award, had the honor of serving in that capacity with the Library Foundation. And I probably didn't know this at the time, but Mike and I actually are colleagues at Franklin College.
Yeah.
So I probably should have filled out a conflict of interest form or something like that.
Yeah, the book Three Islands, well, writing poetry for me is like putting together puzzles. And I really think of poems as trying to pack as much as I possibly can into a small space. So, I don't know, sort of like photographs or just capturing a moment in a small space. So Three Islands, persona poems, so writing from another character's point of view, but sort of another your own voice in a mask is kind of what it is. And the three characters that I was dealing with in Three Islands are Robert Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz, Fletcher Christian, who mutinied the ship called Bounty, and Amelia Earhart. And for me, the process was just sort of being obsessed with all three of these characters one at a time, and then realizing the connections. And once I sort of put them on a map, literally and figuratively, I found that it was one book. So the process for me was just sort of getting to know those three voices and matching them with my own sort of curiosity about isolation and escape.
And what was the source of the obsession, as you say it? Why those three as opposed to three other historical figures?
Well, I feel like they chose me, really. I mean, it was one at a time. I never thought of this. Well, I didn't start thinking about this as one project until I was way into it. I was thinking about it as three different books for a long time. And Amelia Earhart, I've always sort of been interested in stories with no absolute end, sort of mysteries. So Amelia Earhart was just sort of something that I had already been thinking about. And then the other two came to me. I visited Alcatraz and was just sort of thinking about what would it be like to be in a cell all the time and on an island. Fletcher Christian, I happened to be reading an article about him in The New Yorker, and thinking about mutinying a ship and crashing it on an island on purpose to just try that out, living in paradise. So then the three sort of started having all kinds of strange connections, and that's how the project became one.
I'd like to remind our listeners that they can join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps, why do you write? I mean, what's the motivation? What drove you toward it?
Thanks for having us on today, John.
Oh, sure.
I love to talk. The bigger audience, the better. you know, I think writers do deal with obsessions. Micah used that word. But I think I'm also writing in some ways to try to capture stories that I grew up with and stories that I have in my imagination because of my heritage. I grew up in Milan, Indiana, which is a place that's probably familiar to some listeners for its hoops history instead of its writers. But I grew up on a farm outside of Milan. My parents still live on that farm. It's still very much my home. And we raised beef cattle there. We still do. And had agricultural land. And I felt like those stories that I was seeing, particularly with the animals and as my brothers and I fished, were important. And maybe more than that, not being told. And so I think I've always written about those kinds of places, those people. And I don't want to say I'm paying respects, but I think I am trying to capture a heritage that, again, maybe isn't being written about.
Well, what is it you say you want to capture a heritage or whatever? Why is that important to you? And I'm not saying that to challenge, but more to sort of elicit.
Well, I tell my students, I teach at DePaul University in Greencastle, and I tell my students, particularly if you're writing nonfiction, but even if you're writing fiction or writing poetry or plays, you know, you want to tell stories that maybe others can't share, or you want to write about things that you're obsessed over that others aren't. And the family farm, of course, is dying. Most of our farms are becoming subdivisions, and people are finding other ways to make, you know, to make a living. And so I feel like there are fewer people who can tell those stories simply because there are fewer people who are living those stories. And again, I don't pretend that anything I'm putting down on paper is going to somehow live on or have, you know, some long-lasting impact, but it is my tiny way of saying, you know, these people have stories too, and they should be heard or deserve to be heard.
So the motivation really is, it's not characters that speak to you, it's almost a landscape. Or
very much about the landscape, yes. And people are so connected to that landscape that it's very easy to write about both of them together. But I think I'm probably more of a regionalist in the sense that I am writing about Indiana's land, and then the people just happen to be on it.
Okay. Floyd Benford Kichler, president of the Independent Book Publishers Association and a publisher here of a wonderful series of books for young people, Patriot Press. How did you get into the book business? It was because it was the path to fame and fortune, or was there some other motivation that drove you?
Well, I don't know if your listeners could hear, we're all laughing when you said it's a path to fame and fortune, because we all know here at this table that's not true. But now that you've heard a little bit from Greg and Micah, I think everybody out there can understand why I went into publishing. And it's because I get the opportunity to work with wonderful people like these two authors that you've just heard from. I never wavered on my career path from the time I was in college. I knew I wanted to be a book publisher. And I was fortunate enough to be able to work for one. Since we're talking about regional, I worked for a publisher right here in Indianapolis called Bob's Merrill. And then, of course, started my own business, my own publishing business, to publish a classic children book series that was originally published by Bob's Merrill here in Indianapolis. So I definitely have that same regional connection that Greg was talking about.
Yeah, those of us of a certain vintage remember those books as the orange books that were always in a row in the elementary school library. You said you wanted to be a book publisher. Now, that's, you know, on the list of fireman, astronaut, you know, all of those things. That's not a typical childhood aspiration. What was it that said book publisher, as opposed to, say, being, you know, Greg or Micah or someone like that, and saying you wanted to write?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I do get asked that a lot. And my best answer in terms of the writing is I find writing to be excruciatingly difficult. In fact, I think I would rather go have teeth pulled than write. But I am a reader. I'm a huge reader, and I've been a reader since I learned how to read. And as much as I loved books, I was looking for a career path that would match me up with that love of books. And so, of course, I had to pick book publishing. I was an English major, but I also got a degree in business. So you match business and English together, and what do you come up with? Well, of course, book publisher.
And why the series of children's books? Why did you choose that series in particular?
The series that John is talking about was, many of you may remember, the old Childhood of Famous American series. And the reason that I chose that is because I loved it when I was a child. My children loved it. And I started looking around thinking, you know, if this series has survived two generations, I bet that the third one is going to love it too.
Well, and those books first came out, what, starting around 1930, I think?
1932.
Mm-hmm. 1932. Now, what I want to talk about when we get to the other side of the break here is a little bit about, you know, at some level, what sustains you. I mean, in a time when things are changing rapidly in the publishing industry, and really what kind of relationships writers are expected to have with readers. We joked leading up to this that, you know, no one expected William Faulkner to blog, but that is part of the writer's life these days, and there is some expectation that writers will do that. We'd like to talk about that. We also would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. Please stay with us. Thank you.
Limits is made possible by your membership and by Terry Lee Honda and Avon, offering options in car buying. First-time visits are for fact-finding to enable informed buying decisions with all the information. That's TLC, the Terry Lee Commitment. More at TerryLeeHonda.com. And by the Butler University Center for Faith and Vocation, presenting an evening with Coach Brad Stevens, speaking about his life and coaching career, choosing a path, living a dream, Wednesday, September 15th at 7 p.m. at Clues Memorial Hall. Information at butler.edu. And by Broadway Across America. From Disney and Cameron McIntosh comes Mary Poppins, the Broadway musical. Performances begin Tuesday, September 23rd at the Murrah Theater at Old National Center. Tickets for this two-week engagement are available through Ticketmaster.com. You're tuned to No Limits here on 90.1 FM for your information. Tune in for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. You are listening to No Limits here at WFYI. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today with Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps, Michael Lane, author of Three Islands, and Flory Benford Kitchler, president of the Independent Book Publishers Association. And we're really talking about writing and reading and how the relationship between writers and readers may have changed in this age of new technology, new technological developments. I think I'm going to throw the first question probably to Flory, because there are a lot of stories about, you know, the future of the book is imperiled and all of that because of new means of delivering information and all of that. Is that a concern of yours? Is it realistic? And if it is, how far away is it? I guess that's three questions, not one, but take whichever one you prefer first.
Well, I'm far from believing that the book is dead and reading is dead. In fact, I'm more optimistic than ever that all the new formats are not chasing readers away, but rather embracing them. And particularly when you think about the generation that is coming up in school, they reading on a screen is simply a way of life for them. It's not a gee whiz or a wow, this is so cool. It's kind of, okay, well, here it is. And I firmly believe that electronic books, print books, reading on a screen, reading on a laptop, reading on an iPhone, no matter where you're reading, at least you're reading. And I think that's the most important takeaway from all this is let's not worry about how this content or these words are delivered. Let's just worry about how we're going to make sure that the generations keep on reading.
And what will that do to publishing? I mean, to book publishing in particular. I mean, in theory, you know, historically, basically, the publishers were the conduit for readers to connect with audiences. They provided the avenue of communication, but there's nothing to stop, say, Michael Ling now from putting her poetry on a website or a blog, asking people to subscribe. In some ways, she doesn't need publishers anymore. Is that a source of concern or not?
Well, I think certainly from the publisher's point of view, it is somewhat of a concern. But I have to say that I get a lot of questions from writers saying, well, should I publish my own book? And I say, well, I think you need to really decide what you want to do. Because if you want to publish your own book, that means you're going to have to deal with sales, you're going to have to deal with marketing, you're going to have to deal with invoicing, you're going to have to deal with warehousing. Do you really want to do that, or do you want to write? It's going to be very difficult to do both well.
And how about it? Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps? I mean, would you want to do that stuff, or would you prefer to work with a publisher?
I would much rather work with a publisher. I have to say, though, I'm like the oldest 38-year-old, I think, on the planet. But I was really scared to death that when my book was finally published, that it would be e-published, and my publisher would send me an email and say, congratulations, your book is done, check your inbox. And that was my nightmare, simply because from the time I was tiny, it was my dream to have a book of my own that I could hold and carry around the house. And so I've warmed up to the idea some. My book is supposed to be available in an e-format soon. I think that's kind of neat now that it exists. Granted, you know, it's just a paperback publication, but I was so proud of that physical specimen. And I sort of fear the day when we only have ebooks. Again, I've warmed up to the idea. I agree with Flory. It's so easy for younger people to read on screens. I think they, you know, they're so used to that's what they'll expect. And it probably does spell the end of books in paper form, but that's going to be a sad day, I think, to me.
Michael Lane, do you want to connect directly with the readers, or would you rather go through the publisher?
Oh, I would much rather go through the publisher as well, for the same reasons that Greg said. And, I mean, there's something great about the relationship between the publisher and the author and editing and, you know, going back and forth and then getting that product. And I also think that maybe because the new generation is so used to technology and having everything available on the screen, that maybe books will remain sort of an escape, a way to walk away from the computer every once in a while and have this thing that you carry around the house. And, you know, I think that's going to remain, you know, the relationship between books and having this thing in your hand and flipping the pages and having something that you love in your house and not just something you can pull up on the screen.
Now, do you find, and I'll toss this out to any of the three of you, that the relationship with the audience is different based on the medium, whether they arrive at it through an ebook format or whether, and maybe I should back up a bit. How many of you read ebooks? I mean, do you have I know Flory has one. Do either of the two of you have any, and I'm not going to mention any of the names for product endorsement reasons here, but.
I haven't read an ebook yet.
I haven't either, no. I download books sometimes and listen to them when I'm commuting.
Okay.
But
on an MP3 player,
right,
or something like that? Okay, so it's like listening to a book on tape,
right,
a book on CD,
yeah,
and all of that. What do you notice a difference when you're reading Flory on the ebook?
Well, I'll have to say that I do have an ebook reader, and I do like it for some things, particularly for travel. It's wonderful because you can carry, you know, thousands of books with you in something that weighs 10 ounces. But I'm a baby boomer, and I grew up with books, and paper books are still my first love. But I actually do both. I've had to sort of train myself to do the e-reader, but now that I've trained myself to do it, I do like it for some things. But I would be very unhappy if it was my sole source of reading.
And is the experience different reading through that, would you say, or is it a...
The experience is different to a point in that you're not turning, physically it's different because you're not turning pages, but in terms of the information, no, I'm still getting the information that I would get if I were reading a, quote, real book, and that does not bother me. Now, if I were reading something that was heavily illustrated, then I might notice more of a difference, but with just plain text, I really don't.
And do you think, would you write differently for that? Sort of medium, Greg or Micah, if you're connecting with your readers through an electronic medium, basically, rather than the more traditional one, does that alter the way you approach your material?
I don't know if it would change the way I approach the material, but when I'm writing, I mean, especially writing poems in lines is very much about how it looks on the page, and so to me, you know, I'm looking at it on the page, and even when I'm writing on a computer, I print off the page to see how the lines look. So I guess it's just sort of, I assume that my readers will be seeing pages when I'm writing, but I don't know if that would change the way that I write or how I approach it.
Go ahead, Greg.
I think
Greg
certainly course. Our number one goal as writers, I think, would always remain the same, which is you want to produce quality work. You want to have a story that has some sort of appeal or a poem that has some value. And in that sense, you would want to believe that however it was presented, that quality would come through.
And, you know, when you are writing, I mean, you've all talked about the fact that we tend to think of these books in you know, a traditional format that... I suspect we're all of the age where we think of writing as something that you would carry around the house, and you have that proud moment. Do you think it's going to change the way people approach writing at all? There's silence on that one. I clearly stumped the panel.
I would say that I think I think some writers, young writers in particular, are sort of training themselves to write in very short forms because they see sort of everything as maybe a blog entry or a slightly long text.
We're jumping ahead here, but I did want to ask. We made the joke about how no one expected William Faulkner to blog, entertaining as those might have been at 3 o'clock in the morning. Do you get some pressure from either your audience or from your publisher, frankly, to blog? Flory's nodding her head and saying, well, maybe. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, from a publisher's point of view, it's all about author's platform. And what's meant by that is what can the author bring to the table to help sell the book? And authors are being asked to do a lot more now than they ever were before, and that's because of the proliferation of social media outlets. They can from their own home and their own desk and do that. So I think from that point of view, there is a lot more pressure. Sitting in the publisher seat, there is a lot more pressure on authors to sort of sell and market their books.
And are you getting, Greg, has that been your experience? You're nodding your head. Greg Schweppes.
I did develop my first website ever. I didn't think I would ever have a website, but there was some pressure from the publisher to develop a website. And I have to say, it's really pretty cool. I have a website I got a lot of help with, but we have some catfish pictures up there and an email button. And, to have readers, should they choose to do this, be able to send an email instantly is an amazing thing, and it's just a great way for someone to offer feedback to me, and maybe they wouldn't have if they had to, write a paper letter. So that part's very neat.
Okay, Micah, how about you?
I haven't received a lot of pressure to blog per se or promote myself necessarily from my publisher, but I've taken it on myself to. I started a blog where I review books in 200 words And I never thought that I would start a blog for a long time. I just didn't understand what blogging was or what the point was. But now I feel like I do have a relationship with the people who read my blog or my website and with what I'm writing. And it's also gotten me to read a lot more. So I'm reading a book every week and reviewing it in 200 words. And even though there's no pressure on me, I feel like I have to do it every week, and I know that people are reading it, so.
Yeah, great.
Micah's website is bookpunch.com. She's too modest to say that, but it's an excellent, excellent site. And what's great is that she's offering a real valuable service because she's reviewing those books. I don't know what I would say on most days personally if I had a blog, but Micah's site is really helping readers.
Well, why did you settle on like the 200 word limit or?
Well, this all started sort of as a dare, okay. And I'm a very competitive person, usually just with myself. But once someone said, "I bet you could probably do this." Well, maybe you couldn't. Then I've got to do it.
Okay, so you're susceptible to head games.
Well,
then.
So well, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So I was I wanted to review a book for a magazine and. For Esquire magazine, for Tom Chiarella, and a friend of mine and colleague at DePauw University. And he said, well, no, it's too late. It's already been out. Esquire would never print that. But I'd like to see you do that, 200 words. So I did it in, 3 hours. I wrote this review, 200 words. And he was just like, that's okay. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. You should do this every week. You should do this. And I sort of laughed at it. And then I did it the next week, and then I did it the next week, and until it was just sort of, I can read a book in a week and review it in 200 words. It's kind of like writing a prose poem. So now it's kind of easier, and I love doing it.
So what sort of books are you drawn to? I mean, if people go to bookpunch.com.
I try and vary it, novels, short stories, poetry, nonfiction, anything. I read the New York Times book review, anything that just catches my eye. I also have people sending me books now and just recommending books, and so I'm never at a loss of something to read at this point.
I would like to remind our listeners that they can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Also leave comments on Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. We're talking with Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps, Michael Ling, author of Three Islands, and Flory Binford Kitchler, president of the Independent Book Publishers Association. We're really talking about reading and the future of the book. What we've talked about so far is really what e-books have done. Is there anything, and most recently we were talking about sort of this pressure to connect with your audience in a forum really outside the books. Does that bother you at all? I mean, there is a school of thought that the book, you know, once you've written it, it should stand by itself, and there are authors who say, you know, I won't even do publicity tours, I don't want to do signings, I don't want to do anything, because the book has its own life, and it, at some level it becomes separate from me. Greg Schwipps, your thought.
You know, it's such a strange thing to be sort of reticent to talk to your readers. To me, that's the absolute dream, you know, to have somebody read your work and take it seriously and give you feedback on it is really the best thing I can think of. In whatever medium that feedback comes to me, if they've read the work and taken it seriously, they've done more than I could ever hope for.
Micah?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think giving readings, even when your audience is four or five people, or if you're speaking to a huge crowd, you always learn something about your own material. It's sort of like teaching a class. You know, you can't teach a class without learning something yourself. So I think, you know, interacting with your readers is crucial, and just reading your own material over and over really teaches you something about what you're doing.
Flory, are there authors out there? I mean, is that a source of concern that you have more of a relationship, with the author than the book? I mean, is that?
I don't think so, because I think just listening to Micah and Greg talk, it sort of brings it home, the fact that the one. You can say what you want to about technology. It has its good and bad points. But the one thing that it has done for certainly the reading community is it allows that interaction, direct interaction between authors and readers on a scale that could never have been dreamed of 20 years ago. And I'm not an author myself, but just listening to Greg and Micah, I can certainly understand that how wonderful it would be to be able to have that interaction and have it be so easy and so seamless. And yes, you can walk away from it if you want to. You don't have to be on the computer all the time. But I think it's actually done a wonderful service for the whole bringing the reader and the author and hence the book together.
What have you learned? We've got about 2 minutes before the break. What have you learned from your readers? I mean, and from this interaction, what's the biggest lesson you would say? You're both looking pensive and thoughtful here, and not giving me an obvious signal, so I guess I'll go to Michael Lane.
Especially with Three Islands, I think it's kind of a complicated concept, and it sort of takes a while for people to understand how in the world these three people could be connected, and or why I did it, and or why I got obsessed with these three people. So I think what I've learned from my readers is what they've found in the connections. I know so much about these three people and about the process of getting to know their voices and writing the poems. So I'm always interested in what readers find, usually things that I didn't even know, or poems that they found sort of paralleled each other. So I'm always interested to talk to people about what they think of the connections, because I'm sort of in this world too deep.
You're listening to No Limits on WFYI 90.1 FM. We're talking about books and the future of reading with Greg Schwipps, Michael Ling, and Flory Binford Kitchler. And we'd invite you to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I see we have some callers who are eager to join the conversation, and we will pick them up when we get to the other side of this break, where we thank the people who helped make this program possible. Please stay with us.
President and CEO. I'd like to thank everyone that has contributed to WFYI this year. With the economic challenges, including a 50% decrease in state funding, your membership has been more important than ever. It's individual contributions from viewers like you that keep the programs you love on the air here at WFYI. So please, help us reach our fiscal year-end goal. Let's get an update.
Hi, I'm Janelle Adamack, Executive Vice President. We must raise $253,000 by September 30th to reach our $3.4 million goal. Pledge online at WFYI.org.
Welcome. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today with Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps, Michael Ling, author of Three Islands, Florey Binford Kitchler, the president of the Independent Book Publishers Association. We're talking about reading and the future of the book, past, present, and future of the book. And before I move any further, we need to correct something that apparently in the last segment, when, and Mike is actually a little embarrassed that she did not catch this, the website listing her book reviews is actually bookpunchreviews.com. A listener caught that and called it in and told us about it. We are appreciatively shamefaced now.
Thank you.
About that. I would also invite people to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also email us at nolimits@wfyi.org or send comments via Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. We do have a caller right now who wants to join the conversation. Is this Joseph?
Yeah, I'm Joe.
Hi, Joe. This is John Krall. Thank you for joining the program. Good to have you here. You have a question, I presume. Sir? It looks like we just lost the call. It sounds as if we're having a few technology problems. Basically, there was a question in the short summary I saw. It said that it was about online publishing. Are there upsides to this? I mean, I know, and I'll speak, my background was primarily in newspaper work. And when I got into the business as a columnist and editorial writer, at that point, if you wanted to get into the newspaper business, even with the smallest weekly in some small town, this was back when dinosaurs still roamed the earth, but at that point, you had to be able to have millions of dollars, literally, to own a newspaper and to be a publisher. Now, of course, anyone who can spend $10 a month to have space on a server and has access to a computer, even if it's in the local public library, can call himself or herself a publisher, put up a blog and all of that. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Flory, I'll let you go first.
I think it can be both. I think it's wonderful that, again, technology has allowed so many people to have a voice. But the flip side of that is that so many people have a voice. And what I mean by that is that there's so much out there that it's a constant noise and constant clutter, and it makes it even more difficult for any one title to stand out above the rest.
Well, and is there the argument, obviously, is that there's no one vetting this material, too. So there's no one saying it's good. Good, bad, or indifferent, is that a valuable service? I'll say to Mike and Greg, and then apparently we do have Joe back on the line, so I'll take that call in a second. I want to give you a chance to chime in, though. Greg, how about if you go first?
I think quality matters, and publishers have traditionally been the gatekeepers, and that was always frustrating for me because they were closing the gate in my face. But as that starts to change, maybe, hopefully, you appreciate a gatekeeper in some ways. You want someone to help present quality work to help you separate the wheat from the chaff.
How difficult was it for you to get published?
Almost impossible, it seemed. I spent about 6 years writing my novel, found a small press in Denver, Colorado, but I couldn't count the number of no's I received on every level, from other agents, presses, small presses. I mean, journals with individual pieces. Oh yeah, just a ton of no's.
How about you, Micah? How difficult was for you to get published?
It was difficult. I mean, same sort of process. All kinds of rejections. I saved them for a little while and then just stopped. But I think there's something to the relationship that you have with someone who says yes, I'll print your material. You know, there's something to seeing the books that were put out by the press that I'm with, Sunny Outside, and deciding, yeah, I would like them to put my book out, and shaking someone's hand, and that whole interaction and relationship. I don't think that I would have the confidence if it were all done over emails.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Joe to join the conversation now. Joe, are you with us?
Yes.
We have resolved the phone issues here.
The gods of the cell phone world sometimes.
Oh, so you're on a cell.
Yeah,
all right.
Just don't like you, you know?
I know. It's good to know that we can blame modern technology for that. What's your question?
Well, one comment, though. Okay. I think you value something you have to pay for. Mm-hmm. You know, and when it's free on the Internet, I'm not sure you value it quite as much as if you have to buy a book. But my other question then would be if a publisher, you know, doesn't have the cost of distribution and, you know, can sell a book online, does that make up for the cost of distribution? And could they actually sell more books because they can sell them cheaper through an online service rather than maybe in hard copy?
That I'm guessing that's a question for Flory Benford Kitchley, the president of the Independent Book.
Right, you've got writers there, but maybe they have a sense to talk that over with their publishers or not.
Yeah,
that's my question.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Okay,
take care.
Flory? Well, your point is a good one, Joe. Certainly, if you publish online, there is not the physical cost of distribution and paper and binding and all that, but there still is a cost associated with that book. Certainly, if you have a publisher publishing a book online, it still goes through the editorial process, and it still goes through the publicity and the marketing process, so there is still value being added that way. The jury is actually still out, and this is what is sort of sending the whole publishing world into a hubbub as we speak, is just that very question. Are really more ebooks going to be sold than print books? Right now, the answer is no. Whether the answer is going to be no in a couple of years, we don't really know for sure.
Could we walk through real quickly? I mean, we talk about the economics, and this is what Joe was getting to. Say you've got a book that's being published with a list price of $20. Mm-hmm. I know most of them are more expensive than that now, but that makes the math easy. We could even make it 10 if we wanted mm-hmm. to. For how much of that is tied up in the actual physical product? How much of it is editorial service? How much of it is sales and marketing? And then probably the piece that Greg and Micah would know about. How much of that does the author get? Yeah. So.
Well, it's hard to generalize, and so I'm not going to generalize, but I will say what I know from my own publishing company, and that is that, for just as an example, our hardcover books sell for $15.95, and by the time the retailers get their cut and you pay for print and production, the author can get as much as 10%, depending on the volume, and then whatever's left the publisher gets, which sometimes can be almost less than a dollar. So there's an awful lot of middlemen in there taking a big piece from that book. I think that my own prediction, and this is only my own prediction, but I think that's going to change. I think we're going to see elimination of some of the middlemen because there's really no reason for it anymore. There just isn't, because there's just too many ways that people can go direct and get books. So it will be interesting to see how that all shakes out in the future.
So we're in this chain then, where events connecting writers with readers, where you've got a book publisher, presumably a bookseller, and then the reader. At which point are things most imperiled right now, or where is it? The bookstore, it sounds like, that might be under the most pressure right now, because Go ahead.
Well, certainly independent bookstores in particular are under a lot of pressure right now. There are some things that some think are going to relieve some of that pressure, not the least of which I was just talking with Mike and Greg before the show started, is the new machine that is actually printing books on site in stores. And I won't say any brand names, but this is a real machine and is up and running in certainly more than one bookstore. And what it allows the bookstore to do is basically offer any book on the planet. It is working best right now for those books that are really, really hard to get. The long tail sort of book that maybe has been out of print for a long time or only sells maybe 10 or 20 copies a year. But as long as they have the electronic file for that book, a 250-page book can be printed and bound in about 3 minutes in a bookstore.
Oh, man. And could you explain real quickly for our listeners when you talk about a long tail book, what that term means?
Sorry, I'm guilty of industry jargon.
That's okay. That's all right.
That just means the long tail just refers to a book that is still selling, but it may only sell 5 or 10 or 20 copies a year, but it does sell that many, and it will keep selling and selling and selling and selling as long as it exists.
So is anyone making money out of books these days? Because I know the numbers. Actually, I had a book come out 8 years ago, and I remember what was a really, really depressing statistic for me was to read that there were 600,000 published authors in the United States, and only 3,000 of them didn't have day jobs. That, you know, the writing was not going to sustain you unless it was writing a book, which I'd always aspired to. It sounds like the publishers are being squeezed, the bookstores are being squeezed. Is there anyone making money out of this, or significant amount, Flory?
I'm certain that John Grisham and Stephen King are making significant amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. That's true, although King in particular has done some experiments where he's tried to get around the publisher to some degree, right, where he offers the book up directly and you buy it online electronically.
Well, and I think that in a way that does a disservice because certainly mega, hugely best-selling authors can get away with that because they've already built up their zillions and zillions of readers. It's a little bit harder for a mid-list author, meaning an author who maybe isn't a Stephen King, still sells a respectable amount, but maybe may not be a household word. It's a little bit harder for that sort of an author to dispense with a publisher and still maintain that connection with their reader.
Well, let me toss this back to Greg and Micah, because we have talked a bit about how the relationship between readers and writers has changed with all of this. I guess I'd like to ask each of you, what kind of relationship do you want to have with your readers? I mean, what seems to be would be the ideal way you would want them to approach you and your work?
Well,
Greg keeps deferring to Micah.
I appreciate that a lot. Yeah. I like it. I still see what I'm doing as just my art. And so if anyone is appreciating that, I think it's really great. And, I can't imagine that I'll ever even be close to the same world as these huge name authors that we're talking about and huge publishers. So to me, it's sort of just an appreciation for art. And so as long as that's going on, I'm pretty happy. And, you know, if a class in New York is going to teach my book and I'm going to sell 30 copies, that's great. But I don't expect to sell thousands and thousands of copies. And I think the relationship between me and the reader is just an appreciation for art. And I think it's crucial to continue to promote independent presses and independently locally owned bookstores, because that's where that appreciation of the art is really solid. And I'm always trying to promote locally owned bookstores and small presses, because there's something in the art of making a book too, and so to support the small presses is kind of like a different world from these enormous productions.
Greg.
Yeah, it's true. And I would say I don't know who's making money. I can tell you, though, who's saving money, and that is the consumer. It's so easy to get books inexpensively now. And as Micah pointed out, this isn't always the best way. I mean, you can find a book online. You could pay pennies for it. You're probably doing more for local writers and publishers by buying that book, maybe at full price from an independent bookstore. But I would add to what Micah said earlier, or just echo what she said really about appreciation sort of being the ultimate reward from a reader. The best review I got on my book didn't actually come to me, but someone told my mom that she had given her book, her copy of my book to her husband. He was a farmer. He had hay to cut, and he said, "I really need to rake that hay, but I can't put that book down." That's the best review I've ever gotten.
Oh, that is nice. I'd like to talk. We talked a little bit about how difficult it was for you to get published, and that's been sort of the other knock, at least on the big publishers, is that they've sort of closed the gate to some degree, unless you are a Stephen King or a John Grisham and they know they're going to get a massive return on their investment. They're not necessarily looking for new writers and new titles these days. Is the future really of literature then with these small presses and with the small publishing houses? I know that's a little bit of self. Invites all of you to say something self-serving, and I will allow you to get away with it.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. How many new writers are being published every year? Would you say, Floria?
Well, it's hard to say, but I do have one statistic, and this is from 2008, I believe, that there were more than 750,000 books published in that year. That is just staggering. So, yeah, take a moment to let that one sink in, which harkens back to what we were saying before, that there's an awful lot of competition out there.
And how many of those books end up making any kind of money? Is that very few?
Yeah,
very few.
I think very few.
Okay. Well, listen, we have been talking today about books and the future of reading and writing with our guest, Greg Schwipps, author of What This River Keeps, Micah Ling, who is the author of Three Islands, and Florrie Binford Kitchler, who is the president of the Independent Book Publishers Association. I should say that we will find out whether it's Greg or Micah or Douglas Light, who has been named the emerging author award winner at the October 9th dinner for the Indiana Authors Award. I'd like to thank Greg, Micah, and Florrie for joining us. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week about the declining center of American politics. Thank you for being with us.
Is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Executive Director, Mary Hartnett. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Josh Hamig. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.